Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 34. Chicago. Viewed in the perspective of more than half a century, the outstanding characteristic of the Christian Science movement during the next 3 years, from 1885 to 1888, is expansion. This phase of it completely overshadows all others. It entered the period as a Boston craze. It emerged from it as a national and even international religious movement. Comments and criticism, attack and defense, are no longer confined to local newspapers and periodicals. They appear with increasing frequency in national magazines and are often placed in the forefront of debate. Mrs. Eddy made the utmost use of it all. No attack of importance was allowed to go unanswered, and so great was the interest in the subject that the circulation of the journal increased rapidly, not only among professed Christian Scientists, but much further afield. An attack in the Century magazine 1 month, like that, for instance, of the Reverend Dr. J. M. Buckley, entitled Christian Science and Mind Cure, which appeared in the issue for July 1887, would be followed by a reply in the journal in the next. And many Century readers would buy the journal containing the reply in order to see how Mrs. Eddy, or some one or other of her supporters, handled the matter. Mrs. Eddy, it would seem, seldom replied to these attacks over her own name, but often the unassigned reply occupying a first place in the journal would leave little doubt as to who was its author. How rapid was the expansion of the movement is well illustrated by the closing words in the reply to Dr. Buckley, in which the writer comments upon the change which has come over the face of things in 1 short year. It is a most gratifying sign that the Century devotes so much space to Christian Science. A year ago, the editor returned with thanks an article on this subject, giving as a reason for his refusal that there was no such theme as Christian Science. Now, this title heads the Century article. When the Metaphysical College was established in 1881, the president reluctantly accepted the title because Christian Science was a thing unknown to legislators, and this was the only fit name by which she could secure incorporation. Now, the Massachusetts legislature incorporates academies and societies under the caption, and without a murmur. The world moves spiritward. But if it so moved, it was largely because Mrs. Eddy determined that it should, or rather that nothing that could be done to make it so move should remain undone, as far as she was concerned. Her energy and resource were alike inexhaustible. In these 3 years, she taught no fewer than 20 regular classes, besides undertaking innumerable cases of special instruction. She wrote regularly and copiously for the journal, and attended with her own hand to a correspondence which increased steadily week by week and month by month. In addition to this, she had the personal direction of a movement, which, having spanned the continent, stood in sore need of consolidation. Her great aim about this time seems to have been the training of apostles in the simple sense of the word. She must have students who could undertake for her, who could be trusted to go into a new field and speak with authority and act with wisdom, and teach and preach with understanding. And so, in the journal for February 1886, she calls vigorous attention to the need for teachers and for teaching. In a circular letter which she sent out to students in different places throughout the country, she emphasizes the advisability of those prepared to teach to form classes as soon as possible, and to carry on their work through some center which might be known variously as Christian Science Institute or Christian Science Academy. Meanwhile, new churches were springing up everywhere. It was in the fall of this year, 1886, that she took the step, later to be fraught with so much import, of sending Augusta Stetson to New York to establish a church there. Mrs. Stetson was not specially eager to go. She had a large following in and around Boston, preached quite frequently at Hawthorne and Chickering Halls, and altogether occupied a position of no little prominence. She, however, decided to go, and although the work in New York was slow, so slow at first that she twice returned to Boston seeking release from her office, before 2 years were passed, she was preaching to large congregations at Crescent Hall, number 138 Fifth Avenue. And Christian Science was spreading rapidly throughout the state. It was, however, towards the west that Mrs. Eddy, with a sure instinct, persistently turned her attention. In 1887, she sent Josephine Woodbury on a special mission to Denver, Colorado. A minister by the name of Reverend W.D. Westervelt had been conducting a vigorous campaign in Denver against the new teaching, and the leading article in the September Journal was devoted to an examination of one of his essays. Josephine Woodbury was an able speaker with, as has been seen, an attractive personality. And her mission was a complete success. She returned to Boston with word of the growth of the cause in all directions. But while Mrs. Eddy was thus sending envoys further and further west, an academy was established in San Francisco early in 1887, her highest hopes were centered in Chicago. Ever since her visit in 1884, she had seen the movement grow there in a way that was not being equaled anywhere else. From the first, it seems to have attracted people of influence and wealth, who, in the freer atmosphere of the Middle West, were less hidebound than the settled Easterners, and so more contagiously demonstrative. It is true that in Chicago, as elsewhere, of those called and chosen, many in time fell away. But great and increasing numbers remained faithful, and within a few years Chicago had gained a reputation in the movement for soundness which it never lost. In the early weeks of 1888, Mrs. Eddy began to receive urgent calls to revisit Chicago. A way had opened out for her to do so with excellent effect. Some 2 years previously, she had advocated, through the journal, for formation of a National Christian Scientist Association. A Christian Scientist Association had existed, of course, for many years, ever since the earliest Lynn days. But as Mrs. Eddy points out in her notice in the journal for January 1886, this association was exclusively a society connected with the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, and thus necessarily limited in its scope. "I deem it advisable," she says, "that an organization be formed on a broader basis, by which all Christian scientists and their students may come together. And I would recommend that steps be taken by my students throughout the United States to organize a National Christian Scientist Association." This was promptly done, and within a few weeks, namely on February 11th, 1886, the first meeting of the new association was held in New York City. At that meeting, which was necessarily small owing to the shortness of the notice, plans were laid for the development of the larger organization. And in the following year, the first annual meeting of the association was held in Boston at Tremont Temple on Wednesday afternoon, April 13th, 1887. The list of delegates to this first annual meeting shows the extent to which the new teaching had spread throughout the country. No fewer than 14 states were represented: Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, New York, District of Columbia, Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, Missouri, Nebraska, Iowa, and Colorado. The report of the meeting, which later appeared in the journal, dwells upon the evidence afforded of the rapid growth of the movement. "This association," the report said, "only a year old, shows by the interest manifested in all parts of the country the deep root it has taken in the minds of the people, and the attendance shows how many were anxious to see and hear the leader of this great movement." The meeting lasted 2 days, and at the end of the second day adjourned to meet a year hence. This next meeting was held in Chicago. The choice of Chicago was another excellent stroke of policy. As the Far West developed, Chicago was rapidly becoming the favorite city for conventions of all kinds. Then, as now, perhaps the greatest railway center in the country, it offered facilities for the gathering of people from a much wider area than the old convention towns on the Atlantic coast. Mrs. Eddy decided to attend the convention in person, and in order to ensure that it would be a gathering fully representative of the movement, she issued a special plea to Christian scientists everywhere to attend. Let no consideration, she wrote in the journal, bend or outweigh your purpose to be in Chicago on June 13th. She herself left it in doubt until almost the last moment that she would be present. Indeed, it was formally announced in the May issue of the journal that she would not be. She was insisting more and more on the need to divert attention from herself and concentrate it on her teaching. If sometimes the methods she adopted seem unnecessarily severe, there can be no question as to the excellence of her objective. She finally decided to go, and a few days before the convention was scheduled to open, she left Boston accompanied by Captain and Mrs. Eastman, Calvin Fry, and a young physician named E.J. Foster, who was later to figure prominently in the movement. What Mrs. Eddy and those around her actually expected to find in Chicago, it is not easy to say, but there can be no doubt that it exceeded all their expectations. Nothing that had happened up to that time could have afforded more dramatic evidence of the extraordinary growth of the movement. Even before the meeting opened, it was apparent that interest throughout the country in the gathering was sufficient to give it all the advertising and publicity it needed. And as the Christian Scientists from all quarters began to come into Chicago, the newspapers, with a sure instinct of what would be news, published long preliminary descriptions and issued periodical bulletins, most of them familiarly inaccurate, on such vital questions as to whether Mrs. Eddy herself really would or would not be present. The actual number of delegates belonging to the National Association, which assembled, was about 800. But within a very short time after the doors of the Central Music Hall, where the public meeting was scheduled to be held, were opened, the hall was filled to overflowing with an audience considerably in excess of 4,000 people. Mrs. Eddy apparently was unprepared for anything of the kind. She had come to the meeting without any intention of making a formal address. And when told on their way to the platform by the Reverend George B. Day, who was the pastor of the First Church in Chicago, that he had already announced her as the speaker of the day, she was at first quite vigorous in her dissent. But next moment, as she reached the platform, evidently realizing her opportunity, she went to the front and faced the audience. According to the Boston Traveler's report, as soon as she appeared, the audience rose to their feet as one man and remained standing until she motioned them to be seated. Then, without notes of any kind, and evidently depending entirely on the inspiration of the moment, she delivered an address which, in spite of the inadequacy of its recorded form, has come to be regarded as one of her most effective public utterances. The report, preserved in her book Miscellaneous Writings, although excellent in substance and affording occasional views of the strangely compelling quality which must have been in the original, only illustrates anew how much, at all times, the power of Mrs. Eddy's utterances were deepened when they were delivered in person. Science is absolute and final. It is revolutionary in its very nature, for it upsets all that is not upright. It annuls false evidence and saith to the five material senses, "Having eyes, ye see not, and ears, ye hear not, neither can you understand." So, after a few words of quiet greeting, outlining the purpose of the gathering, and pleading for individual consecration, did she move into her subject and set the pace for what was to follow. The speech comprised in all some 3,000 words. There is no attempt at an outline, as was the case with the address in Tremont Temple, but there is a quite remarkable wealth of eloquent reasoning, culminating in telling phrases and unexpected legends of rhetoric, such as may well have roused the audience to eager attention, even when their full import was not gathered. Past, present, future will show the word and might of truth, healing the sick and reclaiming the sinner, so long as there remains a claim of error for truth to deny or to destroy. So it went, culminating in this final statement. Because God is mind, and this mind is good, all is good, and all is mind. God is the sum total of the universe. Then what and where are sin, sickness, and death? There was a moment's silence when she had finished, followed by a scene which, judging from the various reports, must have been indescribable. According to one account, a few days later in the Boston Traveler, the whole audience seemed to rise and move forward towards the platform where Mrs. Eddy was standing. Men and women climbed up, dozens at a time, eager to shake her hand. Those whom she had never seen before, invalids raised up by her book Science and Health, attempted hurriedly to tell their story. Women lifted up their children so that they might see her. And when she finally released herself, it was only with great difficulty that she made her way through the throng, blocking her passage from the door to her carriage. That evening, a reception was given for her in the Palmer House where she was staying. Again, it was all unexpected, and although she went down from her suite and stayed for a few minutes, seeking not to appear ungracious, it was evident to those who were with her that this aspect of her visit filled her with doubt. Once again, people thronged her, and she had to appeal to Calvin Fry, who stood near, for help. It was only with great difficulty they were able to withdraw. Publicly, she never said anything about it. In her message to Chicago, published later in the journal, she has no words but thanks. Privately, however, she implied, as she had done on several previous occasions, that she did not think the cause of Christian Science was advanced by such methods. Only once afterwards did she have a similar experience. That was in New York, about a year later, when she addressed a large audience in the Steinway Hall. After that, she never appeared at any public gathering of a similar kind. But whatever Chicago did for Christian Science, it gave to the movement an unquestioned national character. From now on, it moves forward in this way.